Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
67 years ago.
When in the course of human events.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do.
Hello and welcome. This is a very special 10 American Presidents. Generally, I am off mic, but you might be one of the select few who are actually watching me on Zoom. As a Brit, I am always endlessly fascinated with American culture, American history, American political culture, hence the podcast. Very obviously, America has just seen the inauguration of a new head of the executive and also the head of state, Joseph R. Biden, which got me thinking. Inauguration speeches are something which I haven't actually addressed on 10 American Presidents. And because this is going to be something which we haven't done before on the show, I thought, let's do this in a different way. Let's do this live on Zoom. So I reached out to my good friend Clint Losey, who's an ex-Capitol Hill staffer and is now a speechwriter. Clint, just before we start, why don't you tell us about your time working on Capitol Hill?
I worked for my home state senator from Wyoming on a variety of issues for about 10 years. I left the Hill because politics was getting a little bit sticky. I think everyone can relate to that over the past few years. And now I'm a speechwriter for the head of one of the federal agencies in the D.C. area.
Fantastic. So what we are going to do, what Clint has done is put together, a list of some of the best inaugural speeches. And we're going to listen to some of the snippets of them, and then we're going to kind of dig into the weeds.
Friends and fellow citizens, called upon to undertake the duties of the first executive office of our country, I avail myself
of the presence of that portion of my fellow citizens, which is here assembled. In the warm courage of national unity.
My distinguished guests, my fellow Americans, this is America's day. This is democracy's day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve.
Like most American presidential traditions, this kind of really starts with Washington, doesn't it, Clint? You didn't put down Washington's first inaugural as one of the speeches that you saw as one of the greatest hits. Why not?
Washington's first speech, it's not mandated by the Constitution, first of all. He actually, when he's decided to address Congress, which is who he's talking to after he's been sworn as president, he refers actually to the State of the Union clause in terms of whether or not he should give Congress information and recommendation for legislative action. So he was, he decided to put that off. And so he just spoke a little bit to kind of mark the moment. And so I think that unlike a lot of the greatest hits that we're going to go through and even some of the less great hits that you might decide to talk about, he doesn't really talk about a lot of the traditional stuff that you see in an inaugural speech. And in fact, the first thing he does is talk about how he had been happily retired before the American people dragged him out of retirement, but he guesses he will come do his duty. And then he ends not on some great oration about American unity and greatness and exceptionalism. He basically ends saying, "I'm pretty rich. Please don't pay me a salary. You can cover my expenses." So it was a very kind of make work speech to kick the tradition off.
One thing that I was really struck by learning about Washington, and this isn't me just being a Brit, but that actually he kind of lost more battles than he won. And he wasn't actually a great orator, was he? But he's symbolically, apart from the fact that he's the first president, his strength is in his stoicism. It's a case of in adversity, isn't it? Just keep going on. You know, with this ragtag bunch of patriots. But, you know, he wasn't a great speaker. He wasn't necessarily a philosopher thinker either, was he? And as I seem to remember, when he kind of gave that first inaugural, people could barely hear him as well.
People could barely hear any of the inaugurals up until the early 1900s when you had those speakers and whatnot to amplify what they were saying. But yeah, he wasn't necessarily what you would think of as kind of one of the early American orators. He obviously was one of the great leaders of the nation early on. And I think his story is fascinating in terms of his leadership and how he kind of is such a linchpin in the founding of the nation. But, you know, speech writing goes back to the very beginning. I don't know specifically if his inaugural speech was written by anyone else, but Alexander Hamilton did some speech writing for the president. There's actually a scene of that in Hamilton, the musical, which may not be the last Hamilton reference I make tonight. So just be warned of that. His departing speech to Congress is a great deal more famous than either of his inaugural speeches. And it's one that is still read by tradition in the U.S. Senate every year.
Hmm. All right. So let's go on to our first one. And it's Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural. Just very quickly, set us a scene. It's the election of 1800, and there is rancor in the American body politic.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess we can just get right back to the Hamilton references. If you don't want to play the audio of the speech, we can just do a Hamilton listen party.
Well, we're going to play the audio of the speech, but
all right. The election of 1800 was very rancorous. You know, anyone who kind of peeks into U.S. history around this time, they were, we think that we have a pretty divided and pretty rancorous political environment now. It was very similar, if not worse, in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And one of the things that's really interesting about the Jefferson speech or the Jefferson presidency in general is that it was the first time that power had actually been transferred to an opposing party. Washington was the first president. He was pretty universally beloved. John Adams was in his party. They were co-aligned politically. And Jefferson was not. Jefferson became opposition over the course of the early republic. So this is the first time that we actually had to decide, are we going to give power to our political opponents? And Jefferson does talk to that directly in his speech.
During the contest of opinion through which we have passed, the animation of discussions and of exertions has sometimes worn an aspect which might impose on strangers unused to think freely and to speak and to write what they think. But this being now decided by the voice of the nation, announced according to the rules of the Constitution, all will, of course, arrange themselves under the will of the law and unite in common efforts for the common good. All, too, will bear in mind the sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will, to be rightful, must be reasonable. That the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things.
How different structurally, intellectually, would that speech be from, let's say, a speech that Biden would have given? Give us a sense of that, if you could, please, Clint.
I think you see some of the same things in Biden's speech that you see in that Jefferson just said right there. You have a call to accept the results of the election. These things now being divided by the voice of the nation. So he's basically saying this is done, and it had been an extended process. It had not run the way it normally had. Then you have the call to civility and call to unity. So I don't think that, it's phrased very differently. It's phrased like a very old fashioned speech compared to how we speak today. But I don't think that these sentiments are that far away from things that we're saying here today.
How much is a part of the ethos of the time, what's going on at the time, and how much does that then forge a great speech, a good speech? Because it's not by accident that the speeches that you've picked, so we've got Jefferson's first inaugural, Lincoln's first and second, we've got FDR, yes, we have JFK, and we have Reagan, but the country was in a point of crisis, wasn't it, at the time of those inaugurals. So how important is that in terms of, making a speech? William Harrison, did he give a great speech? And apart from the fact that it was the longest, but actually there was nothing really going on in America at the time. So we just go, type of thing.
I don't think it's a coincidence that the greatest hits, as you might call them, come out of crisis, just because there's so much more to be said. You talk about Harrison's speech. It went on for 8,000 words. He talked about classical history. 30 days later, he died from it. If you look at other speeches, Buchanan, the president who preceded Lincoln, is another one that's looked on as not very good. Buchanan's regarded as a pretty poor president as far as that goes. But there were these crises and these great leaders who rose up to meet them, and so I think that kind of goes hand in hand with a pretty great speech.
Fair enough. Okay, let's go on with our history lesson.
But every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated, where reason is left free to combat it.
It was important, wasn't it, that Jefferson used his speech as a very obvious rallying call to reunite the country. One of the themes which I always hear at this point, well, everybody hears at this point in the American political cycle, is the peaceful transfer of power. Now, we don't want to relitigate what happened on January the 6th at the Capitol. From a British perspective, I always scratch my head and go, well, we were doing peaceful transfers of power from before this election. But it was important, wasn't it, that he had such a divisive election, but still Adams gave up power and Jefferson was gracious in accepting it.
Yeah, I mean, depending how gracious you might think he had been when you dig down into some of the things he was writing at the time. But I mean, this speaks to the passage you play speaks, I think, a lot to just the very rancorous political environment. I'll try and make this my last Hamilton quote. In the musical, they say, "We smack each other in the press and we don't print retractions." You know, we think about alternate news and alternate facts today, but, you know, they had printing presses then too, and they were using them quite viciously. You know, Jefferson here is saying every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. And again, you could hear that today. I think Biden said similar sentiments to try and get people to talk about how we can disagree peacefully. One of the things I like best about that clip you just played is let any who would dissolve this union stand as undisturbed monuments. Like, you know, let people stand as monuments to bad opinions. They'll be gone long after the Republic is still standing. So I think that that's a great sentiment, and one that we're still kind of trying to live up to as we keep going forward.
It's also important, looking back at history. History's there to remind us, isn't it? And things never exactly repeat themselves, but the line is that history does rhyme, though, doesn't it? And here we are thinking that America is more divided than it's ever been. And you look back and there was this election and potentially things were up in the balance. You know, the Republic was still young, but it managed to prevail. So let's move on to a time when it wasn't just a Cold War per se, it was definitely a hot war.
I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature.
Tell us, sir. Obviously, this is a very important inaugural address. Clint, give us a little bit of background and tell us the reason why you think it's so pivotal in the American story.
Yeah, that's Abraham Lincoln on March 4th, 1861. That was given just about a month after seven Southern states seceded and formed the Confederacy. But it was before the actual shooting war started. That would actually start about a month later. So he's in this very precarious time, and that's the closing paragraph of what is actually one of the longer inaugural speeches that we have. I forget exactly how long it is, but I think it's somewhere in the top 10 longest speeches. And he spends so much of that time trying to convince the Southern states to return to the fold. And you know, he talks about the benefits of unity, but also kind of a little bit of a carrot and stick approach to what might happen if they don't come back. I like that passage a lot because it actually wasn't written by Abraham Lincoln. It was written by his incoming Secretary of State, Seward. It was added to the end because Seward thought that he needed to kind of close on a softer note rather than just, you know, kind of laying out his arguments to the states. And if you don't mind, I'd like to just go through the original text that Seward wrote, because it was Lincoln who took that and polished it into the great speech, the great paragraph that we just heard there. Seward wrote, "I close, we are not, must not be aliens or enemies, but fellow countrymen and brethren. Although passion has strained our bonds of affection too hardly, they must not, I am sure they will not be broken. The mystic chords, which proceeding from so many battlefields and so many patriot graves, pass through all the hearts and hearths of this broad continent of ours, will yet again harmonize in their ancient music when breathed upon by the guardian angel of the nation." And there's a lot of great sentiment there. So looking at that as a speechwriter, it's really great to see the leap that Lincoln made when he edited that to be something that's just so much more memorable. You know, "we are not enemies, but friends" sounds so much better than "we must not be aliens or enemies," particularly to our modern ears where aliens are, you know.
Absolutely. Let's move on, because he's the only president that you say so good that we really should have a second hit from Abraham Lincoln.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
So, do you want to tell us exactly when this inaugural was given? The guy actually reading it out sounds exasperated and sounds tired. He sounds like he's just gone 4 years through a civil war. But anyway, I've kind of asked you a question and answered it myself. But anyway, why don't you?
That's exactly where it is. His first inaugural was given in that weird period right between when there was the succession, the attack on Fort Sumter kicked off hostilities, and this one is given in a similar lull period. So the Civil War was coming to an end, actually. Robert E. Lee would be surrendering about a month after the speech was given. Just a few weeks before, the 13th Amendment had been passed to outlaw slavery. And so it, again, was this kind of transition point coming out, much as the first one had been a transition point going in. This is one of the shortest inaugural speeches on the list. And it's just, I think it's about 700 words. And he just sounds so tired. The presidency ages you, and I cannot imagine how aged he must have been. I'm sure that the side-by-side pictures about just how much the Civil War aged Abraham Lincoln really comes through in the text. He spends a good bit of time even, you know, wondering if the Civil War was the price of the sin of slavery. And if anyone thinks that, you know, the Civil War was about anything other than slavery, Lincoln is very clear that it was about slavery. Mm. And then we get to that final paragraph where he kind of tries to give a slightly stoic outlook that better things are coming.
Better things are coming is a kind of a key motif for the next presidential speech, which we move on to the era where we can actually not only see but also hear presidents. So this next one is FDR, and it's the depths of the Depression.
Which the present situation of our people impels. This is preeminently the time to speak the truth, the whole truth, frankly and boldly. Nor need we shrink from honestly facing conditions in our country today. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
For me, is just a great rhetorical kind of flourish. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Again, give us the setup for FDR to deliver this wonderful speech.
We were coming out of the Great Depression, which had been brutal in 1932, and Hoover had basically was seen to have been botched the Great Depression as president in the preceding 4 years. So he looked terrible for that, but then he also looked really bad because these World War I veterans had marched on Washington to demand bonus payments that they were owed. And he had the U.S. Army, led by, I think, George Patton, go out and basically to run them out. So Hoover looked terrible, and FDR was inheriting basically this tremendous mess of the Great Depression. He's just trying to instill confidence here in the American people. And that's why it's such a great phrase. And I think that's why it's lived on so effectively. But, you know, he just keeps it up trying to make a case that there's a way out of this through unity and hard work.
Unity and hard work. These seem to be recurrent themes in these speeches. It's almost as if you Americans need to be reminded that you are actually a united people in these United States.
That's a leading comment there, isn't it? I mean, it's been true for a very long time that one of the functions of the inaugural speech is to bring the nation together and to lay out your own guiding principles and to affirm the strength of the system. And that's not just true in crisis time. That's true when there's a change of power from one party to another that is going to bring in new principles. You saw that with Jefferson, I think, laying out his protection for the voice of the minority and opposition party. And so I think it is an important part of the inaugural to lay those things out and reaffirm them every time that power can change, but that's okay.
Mm. I think I'm going to be right in saying this, but we talked obviously before I hit the button to go live with this, and the position of the British Prime Minister isn't the same as the American president. The American president is the head of state and the head of the executive. The British Prime Minister is just the head of the executive. And obviously the Queen in the United Kingdom is the head of state. So you combine the two roles. But when a new prime minister walks into Downing Street, number one, there is no waiting 3 months or 2 months. Yeah, 2 months and a bit, whatever. It's the next day. The election gets called at, let's say, 12 midnight. At 10 o'clock the next day, they walk in to Downing Street. That's it. And though they might say a few words to the press, it's not a formal thing at all. Famously, or depending on where you sit politically, infamously, Margaret Thatcher gave a speech from Francis of Assisi when she went into Downing Street. And maybe she started a mini tradition that way. How important thematically do you think these speeches are to set the tenor, not for where America is at the moment, but for the administration kind of going forward? You know, do we really see, not necessarily policy, but, you know, the general thrust and ethos of what that president is going to try to achieve in the next 4 years during these inauguration speeches?
I think that the inaugural is really important for putting the new president in a presidential position from the very beginning. I think it's less important for policy, save the policy for the State of the Union, you know, save the policy for other avenues. But I do think it's really important that everyone sees the new president being the president, doing something very presidential. That's something that all of his supporters have been waiting for. So, you know, it's good for them. It's good for the opposition to see, you know, more than any year, this year is the year that, you know, putting the whoever was standing there was a real strong message about the outcome of the election. And then it's the first opportunity to say, you know, in many cases, we've just been through a grueling election. That's pretty much par for the course. And then you do get an opportunity to get up there and make your case for everybody and to bring the nation together and to say that you're going to be the president for all the people, whether you mean that or not.
That was telling what you said at the end there. Let's move on. Being a Brit, and before I became fascinated with American politics, if I knew anything about inaugurals, I knew Nothing to Fear but Fear Itself and the next one, which was Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You, but What You Can Do For Your Country. I think just about every Brit will at least be aware of this next speech.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
For everyone who's viewing this on Zoom, there's two blokes there with top hats on in the background, which I've only just realised. And this is 1960. You know, just those two gentlemen there with their top hats on. It's almost Lincoln-esque, which is quite bizarre. I've only just noticed that. Why did you choose this speech, Clint?
I'll admit I chose that speech because ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country is one of the great American taglines. If there were going to be America the movie, that would be a contender for what would be on the poster. The Kennedy inauguration is a little bit different than the others. It's still a crisis inauguration, but it's not a domestic crisis. It's an international crisis. But one of the main things he's trying to do is rally the people who've been a little bit demoralized by the early years of the Cold War. You know, Sputnik was launched a few years earlier. And so it was a period when Americans were feeling a little bit behind in the space race, a little bit more worried about the USSR than I think that we realized later on that we should have been. But, you know, it was really about recommitting to American principles that, you know, kind of as an article of faith, we're going to be the main way to win the Cold War was through a recommitment to those ideas and principles.
Mm. And I don't know how much this is, you know, kind of with hindsight, but we're always told as well that it was a young president and it's a new decade, isn't it? And it's a real kind of generational changing of the guard as well with that speech as well.
Yeah, the Nixon Kennedy campaigns had been really close, so it was a very tight election as far as that goes, and it was basically coming off of Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, but you know, very nominally Republican, president. He wasn't a political animal at all. And so it was kind of a changing of the guard in that way, rather than a handing off to a successor.
We should really go to another kind of changing of the guard, and which is exactly 20 years later, and it's Ronald Reagan, and here is a political revolution.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
For me, and you're the speechwriter, tonally, this feels different from Kennedy. Kennedy felt like aspirational rhetoric, whereas Reagan seems to be bringing this down, really, and speaking not bluntly, but much more earthly so.
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting about this speech is how different it is in terms of tone. There are sections of it that are aspirational, and there are sections of it where he kind of returns to some of the standards of inaugural speeches. But there's this undertone of cynicism that creeps in, and I think you see it right there in government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. I think you so rarely see the blame game in inaugural speeches, because most presidents are working so hard to foster unity and to kind of make the case that everybody should rally behind them. So I think that's just a really interesting, different thing that Reagan does. And there are a couple other interesting places he kind of goes down that slightly cynical road. Just a couple paragraphs later, he talks about special interest groups, which in the 80s was kind of, you know, that was proto-lobbying, I guess. And so it was just not, you know, it was a fairly negative connotation in political terms.
Well, if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? All of us together, in and out of government, must bear the burden. The solutions we seek must be equitable, with no one group singled out to pay a higher price. We hear much of special interest groups. Well, our concern must be for a special interest group that has been too long neglected. It knows no sectional boundaries or ethnic and racial divisions, and it crosses political party lines. It is made up of men and women who raise our food, patrol our streets, man our mines and factories, teach our children, keep our homes, and heal us when we're sick. Professionals, industrialists, shopkeepers, clerks, cabbies, and truck drivers. They are, in short, we the people. This breed called Americans.
Part of the power of that speech, not only the words, but because he was a great actor, you know, it's a case of, you know, he was hitting all of those marks and all those punches.
First of all, I think that the whole framing of we hear much of special interest groups, and then to pivot to the American people as a special interest group, is, I think that's too cute by half. That's my professional opinion as a speechwriter. But it is one of those interesting things where you know, you talk about, so many speeches are about unity, and they really don't call out specific groups so much as they try and bring people together. And this just strikes me, you know, I was not politically conscious in the 80s, but this strikes me very much as, you know, trying to talk to the conservative base or the working class base in a way that you don't see in a lot of speeches. So I wonder if that is just a little bit cynical on his part.
And also, and I'd only be upset anybody by this, but for me, I think it's a little bit clever than what you are saying. Bearing in mind, this was 1980, right? So we've got, 40-odd years hence of history to view it. But to go from the pivot of interest groups, which would have been, this was a time of affirmative action within the federal government, etc. So he is actually saying those minorities, black folks, well, then they've had their time, but it's you, the Americans. And actually what he's saying, it is a dog whistle, is white America, isn't it? You can easily say, oh, no, because he's talking about all these different professions. But actually, because the way that it's framed, you know, he's saying that, okay, they've had their moment and you felt frustrated that you've been ignored, but actually now it's your time.
Yeah, I think that there's just a lot of pushback against things like that. And basically just conflating government with anything they don't like about government, which I think is part of the conservative movement that Reagan kicked off, you know, the effort to reduce it down to smaller and smaller portion, smaller and power, that's, you know, still part of the platform today in terms of like judging it from 40 years on. I do try and be a little bit cautious about that because things were different in the 80s, and maybe I just don't understand how much more burdensome government was there. But I get the impression that it was just a lot more cynical, and it was a lot more an attack, more that would have been appropriate on the campaign trail or even in a State of the Union. But like it did seem a little bit, like you said, divisive and a little bit dog whistly.
But it is clever to then frame it as we the people. So that was a clever flourish. You connected this with the notes that you sent to me with a speech, which I don't think I'm going to be out on a limb here by saying that I don't necessarily think is going to go down in the annals as a good speech, but it's definitely one with the lens of history, which is viewed incredibly ironically, talking about this American carnage.
What truly matters is not which party controls our government, but whether our government is controlled by the people. January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became the rulers of this nation again. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer. Everyone is listening to you now. You came by the tens of millions to become part of a historic movement, the likes of which the world has never seen before.
But this is the lead up to it, isn't it? So we're about to get to the American carnage.
But for too many of our citizens, a different reality exists. Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities. Rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation. An education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Is it right to say, would it be fair to say that was the darkest of American inaugural speeches?
That's hard to say. Because we did just listen to Lincoln on the verge of the Civil War, but it's a contender. The thing about it is that it is, again, just kind of so cynical. We talk about how much presidents want to speak to the whole nation and want to bring people behind them. And, you know, maybe Reagan was playing with that a little bit, trying to speak to his base a little bit with that very clever special interest groups phrasing he did, but you know, it seems very clear who Donald Trump is speaking to at this time. And Trump did study Reagan's speech specifically when he was writing his own inaugural address. So you have the great communicator being studied by the great miscommunicator in terms of writing this up. those hints of cynicism that you see in Reagan just come out full blast in Trump's speech. And that's just kind of what I think is going to make it part of his legacy, that it's not going to be considered a great speech on its own, but it's going to be, I think, American carnage is going to be the phrase that comes up and again and again and again whenever we're talking about Donald Trump in a historical context. And you know, he coined it for himself.
Mm. Folks, we are rapidly approaching the hour mark. If you're on the East Coast, it's getting late. I know we have Robin in Melbourne, Australia, so it's bright and early for you, Robin. So you've got the whole day ahead of you. Has anybody got anything specifically that they would like to add? It can be a question to Clint. It can be an observation. You can either use the little wave the hand icon on Zoom, or quite literally just wave your hands. Alexander Martone, so you're over there in Brooklyn. You've unmuted yourself. You're a veteran. You know how this thing works. Why don't you ask your question, Alexander?
Thank you. So one of the things we've been talking about is the theme of unity that tends to run through all these speeches, most of these speeches. But most of these administrations, I wouldn't call exactly mild-mannered. Many of them, as you indicated, signaled drastic ideological shifts or changes in how, you know, government functioned, you know, thinking about FDR, for example. Do you think that means that the professions of unity were purely performative, or is there something else there that I'm perhaps overshadowing, right? That there was some kind of, you know, other unity achieved that's not indicated by, you know, centrist government?
I think that it might be a little bit performative or a little bit traditional, rather than, and you know, I'm not going to suggest that any of the presidents who've spoken in their inaugurals about coming together in unity didn't mean that. But it is one of the few times you hear it in a president's rhetoric a couple weeks later or a year after, when they go address Congress in the State of the Union. They still want unity, but they are much clearer about unity achieved by everyone agreeing to what they want, which is, when you're in power, you can make that demand. But I do think it is part of the inaugural speech, which is its own genre of speech. So it's the kind of speech that a person will make only once or maybe twice in their life, and only a very few people will make that speech. And calls to unity are perhaps part of the formula. I don't think that makes it any less powerful or any less meaningful, though. I think it's still a very important thing to contemplate as you decide how you want to lead.
Mm. J.E. Moon, we're going to come on to you in a minute, but I started saying this before about 20 minutes ago, and then I was lost in my thoughts, really. I didn't really nail the landing. Me talking about the fact that in the United Kingdom, the Prime Minister doesn't give a speech, though, as Clint said before we started the show, we do have the, you know, there is the throne speech, there is the Queen's speech, so to speak, which is called the throne speech in Canada, which is all full of pomp and regalia. But that is when your president addresses both houses of Congress. It's similar to that. Within British political life and history, prime ministers giving speeches to the nation isn't really a thing. It isn't really a thing. And it's quite interesting to see the importance or the import that this is kind of given within the American kind of political system. We don't have this in the United Kingdom. J.E. Moon, you've already unmuted yourself. Your hand is up digitally. You're ready to go. Go for it. Ask your question.
Yeah, I wanted to address what you said about the U.S. having to be reminded that it is the United States. And that's very true, because we're a very big country and Americans tend to think of themselves as their states, because the states have rights too. It's not just that we're under a federal government following just the laws of the federal government. We're following the laws of whatever state we're in, and we're voting on those laws too. So you can have a state that is dry, meaning no alcohol allowed anywhere, or you can have one that's, you know, allows drugstores and other places to sell alcohol. and that's the state. And those rules vary from state to state. So it becomes a kind of like rooting for a football team situation. It's hard to remember that it's all one league of football teams. It becomes battles between states, and you can see how the Civil War became that, simply because certain states said, we want our way, we want our laws, and we're not going to give them up. You know, we're not going to listen to what the federal wants us to do. It continues to this day that a president has to remind people that they're part of the United States. Unless it's a world war, we're not going to remember it. We're just going to say, I'm a Californian, or I'm an Arizonan, or I'm... In regards to the prime minister element, I'm sure all my fellow Americans here would love it if we could quickly get the president, especially this time around, if the president could have just left on the day after the election. But once again, it goes back to the fact that it's a very big country. And it used to be that you had the president who was from Illinois, the guy, you know, Abraham Lincoln gets elected. He has to take a train to Washington. He has to, and it's snowing and it's Christmas and, you know, all those other things. And you have to get him into the White House, and it's a big house that has to be cleared out. So it was a much more arduous thing to transition the president than to just, you know, someone who, from Parliament walking down the street and saying, okay, I'm the new prime minister. So,
J.E., that is completely and utterly a fair point. Though, reading the history of the transition, it has been cut down for current. So it was even longer before, wasn't it?
Thank God.
Yeah, the FDR speech that we heard was in March, and then the Kennedy speech was in January. And I think that we should cut it down even further.
Yeah. The other thing to say as well is that, again, if you're a little bit of a student of these things, as I am, you realize the monarchical hangovers between your republican system of government and the way that things are done in the United Kingdom. So even though the Prime Minister literally the next day walks into Downing Street, and that's it. It's utterly brutal. If you've lost that election, you are gone in hours. Gone, right? Not days, hours. But when the monarch dies and a new monarch takes up, that can be a year before that new monarch is crowned. So you see the echoes of this, of you having your head of state, also the head of, who's also the head of the executive, in the fact that there needs to be some kind of regal changing of regime. If Queen Elizabeth II died today, Charles would be king tomorrow, but he wouldn't be crowned possibly for 6 months, 9 months, possibly even a year. There is that kind of little echo of the way the British used to do things. Sorry, J.E.?
I said that's a very good point, yes, because the president has to entertain foreign dignitaries, yeah, and has to act that role too.
Absolutely. Do we have another question? Kevin, you look so relaxed over there in Sacramento. You've obviously had a hard day, Kevin, but you know what? You enjoy your rest, sir. Alexander, you want to come back? I think, Alexander, you're going to, unless somebody else wants to say another question after Alexander, I think that's the perfect hour that we've had. Alexander, ask your question, sir.
So my question is about how the audience for the inaugural addresses has changed over time. From how you were describing Washington's, it sounds like he was really just talking to the other gentleman in the room, right, in the Congress. Right? Also, like, by the way, don't pay me a salary, right? And, you know, certainly now it's broadcast on television, online, and everything. Was Jefferson speaking to a newspaper audience, and Lincoln as well? FDR, I assume, you know, for the radio. And how do you think that affected what they included in the speech and how they spoke?
Yeah, the inaugural has always been intended to be printed for after the fact. You know, as I mentioned before, public address systems, most people wouldn't have been able to hear the speech at all, even if they had been assembled at the Capitol to hear someone giving the speech in the open air. Washington's speech is addressed to the House and the Senate. And I don't know specifically. I think Jefferson, if I recall, was in fact addressing the House and the Senate, but he addressed it to friends and fellow citizens. I'm not sure exactly when the transition from addressing Congress to addressing the people came about, but again, it was always intended to be a speech that would be available to the people, usually in print. That's always been a part of how it's crafted for posterity.
Fantastic. Clint, I keep on calling you my new best friend in Washington, D.C., but I've been saying this for about a month or so, so he still can't be my new best friend. My best friend in Washington. There you go. Thank you for joining us and illuminating us with an insight into inauguration speeches. Fundamentally, Clint, these shows are about me. How did I do?
I think you did great. You asked all the right questions. You had all the right insights.
Brilliant. You know what? Ditto, sir. Hopefully, to the small but important viewing audience on Zoom, Alexander, J.E. Moon, Kevin Woodruff, Michelle, Natalia, we had Robin from Melbourne, and there was somebody else who had to go early as well. Hopefully, you've had an enjoyable hour and also an educational hour. And thank you for being fans of 10 American Presidents. Michelle, I can see you now. Look at you and all your books behind you. Is that a backdrop? Is that really your own personal library?
It's a backdrop from Green Apple Books on Clement in San Francisco.
Oh,
one of the best used bookstores in the country.
Well, hopefully, they'll be stocking my book about how Jamaica conquered the world before the end of the year.
Oh, that'd
anyway,
be great.
Great bookshop. Thank you again, everybody. Thank you for being part of this experiment. I think I just about held my own with Clint, so maybe we'll do this all again soon. Take care. Enjoy the podcast when it goes up. It fundamentally will be this, but without the little fluff which I did in the middle. If you haven't done so already, please write us a review on Apple iTunes or on a podcatcher of your choice. The more reviews I get, the more listeners I get to the show. And also, if you really do like the output, and if you do have any spare pennies in your purse, go on to Patreon and become a patron of 10 American Presidents. The American experiment is a fascinating one. I'm a student of history, and hopefully through my learning about it gives you a little bit of entertainment. Thanks again, everybody. Take care. Have a great evening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us.
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.